It's been almost a half a century since the Vietnam War, and we thought it might be interesting to hear from some people in this community who were affected by it, what their experience was, and what do they think about it these many years later. That's this week on Reality Check on KCIW. I'm Lee Tooley, and I'm hosting this Reality Check about Vietnam, and I'd like to introduce you to some folks who have things to say about the war. Let's go around, say your name, and just briefly tell us what role you might have had in those years so listeners can get to know whose voice is whose.
My name is Ray, and I was a combat medic with the 9th Division.
My name is Hank. I was a combat medic, not a conscientious objector. I don't think you were either, with the 11th Armored Cavalry, although I went over to Vietnam with the 9th Infantry Division.
And my name is Gary. I was a communications technician, interpretive. So I was assigned to Naval Security Group for intelligence collections.
I'm Dan, and I was in the military police at the very beginnings of the initial surge.
So thinking about how to get a handle on this huge subject when we only have an hour, I thought maybe we could start by saying what we were doing at the start of this experience. Like, did you enlist? Were you drafted? Did you resist? What were your thoughts leading up to your involvement? Anybody?
Well, I was drafted out of my cushy little job where I went to work at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I was drafted from Long Island, and all my friends that were drafted had gone to Fort Dix, which was only a couple of hours away from my home, thinking I'd go home on weekends. And they told us we were going to South Carolina. I'd never been any further than New Jersey in my whole life. Went on a train, had experiences on the train driving through areas that I never thought existed.
How's that?
Well, when you travel by train, it's not like going on the interstate. You're literally going through people's backyards. And in mid-1960s, some of those backyards were pretty poor looking.
And that was new for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I got drafted, and after basic training, they assigned me to, I was sent to Fort Sam Houston in Texas. And they give you, for your MOS, they just give you a number. And I asked the sergeant what that was. And he says, oh, you're going to be a medic. You're going to have a good time. Fort Sam is the best place in the Army. And I said, but I pass out when I cut my finger. Oh, don't worry about it. They'll get you over it.
I bet they would. So what were your thoughts at that time? Were you like super patriotic? Were you dragging your heels and wishing you didn't have to go? What was your attitude?
I actually thought that the war was a good thing and we were supposed to be there. It was not, given my choice, I would not have gone. I didn't think it was that good an idea. And I was kind of happy I was going to be a medic and I wasn't going to have to kill people.
That sounds like a good break. Somebody else?
Well, I'm Gary again, and I was just finishing college. I had, first of all, they were drafting at that time. And I had a low draft number, and I was just finishing college, and I knew that my name was going to be called up within just a few months. So I enlisted. I enlisted in the Navy because I didn't like the idea of Marines or Army. I wanted language school, but they wouldn't guarantee me that. They said, no, you have to take a language aptitude test once you get in, so we can't promise you that. So I enlisted anyway in the Navy, and they sent me to, first of all, you take a test. Most people don't bother with the test. I saw it as a challenge. It was kind of fun because they create a language in front of you, give you a booklet, and you just flip one page to the next. You can never turn back. You have to remember your vocabulary and grammar, and they just create a language. And, you know, I scored pretty well on it, actually. And so they sent me to... If you score over 90, you get an Asian language because of the tonal qualities and difficulty of some of the Asian languages. So they sent me to school for North Vietnamese. I have trouble with South Vietnamese. It's quite different, quite a few different, fewer tones in South Vietnamese than in the Northern dialect. And once I graduated, it was an immersion program in the Northern dialect. And once... I graduated from that and passed, certified my tests, you know, for translation work for National Security Agency. Then I was assigned to airborne reconnaissance. So most of my time in the service there in Vietnam were either in aircraft on a small jet or a P-3 Orion aircraft with other people. And so we would sit down on base, but I was never permitted to be off base. So my experience is probably quite a bit different than anybody else's
here. And you came later than these other guys, too, by Pardon? The sound of it. You were actually drafted at a later date than these other folks that were
no,
kind
I,
of in
I
the early days?
No, I was never drafted. I had a low draft number.
Oh,
so
I enlisted,
I'm sorry, to get ahead of that.
But what I'm trying to get to is just you came in much later than these other folks.
Yeah, I enlisted in 1971, so I was there when Saigon fell.
So was it... What was the attitude that you had going in?
Well, I certainly believed it was my patriotic duty to do it. Like Ray, I was not gung-ho on killing anybody or you know, I really didn't want to do anything other than languages. So I had a wonderful experience personally. My war to me was a sanitized thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it was not what anybody else saw.
Right. So when you went in, I imagine that the protest was more advanced at home.
Very much so.
When these guys went
yes,
in.
Yes. Uh-huh. And there was, you saw them all the time, the protests. And even when we were riding a bus, you know, they picked you up at the airport and stuff and down in San Diego. And, you know, there were protesters out there inside the buses, you know, with signs and angry pounding on the buses. As I was being transported onto the base for the first time. That was a horrible experience.
I bet.
I'm sure others can share here.
So when you guys came in, was the protest already going in a major way, or was that still pretty low-key? Because you all kind of went in at the same time, right? 1967, I think you said?
66.
66? 66, yeah.
God, that's a long time ago. Anyway, go on.
When they swore us in as a group of, I don't know, 50 or so, there was one person who refused to swear in, and they took him away someplace. But other than that, no, the protests were pretty minimum when I went in.
Well, I was also drafted in 1966, and I was about a year and a half out of high school. So I was working, I was in the Teamsters Union, working unloading boxcars in Seattle near the waterfront. So I was not a college boy. Mm-hmm. And my wife doesn't like me to say this, but I was from the wrong side of the tracks, definitely. So my future consisted of doing that kind of work, driving trucks, unloading boxcars, and I got drafted. I was 19 years old. I really didn't have any formed opinions as to, I didn't want to get killed. I knew that.
That's,
and I didn't want to kill anybody.
Yeah.
Took a battery of tests and ended up as a medic. So I had no particular interest in medical field, but that's just where they put me. So I also was trained at Fort Sam Houston, Texas. I was inducted at Fort Lewis and then sent to Fort Ord, California, and there was a spinal meningitis outbreak at the time, and then I was transferred to Fort Riley, Kansas, and that's where I joined the 9th Infantry Division. Then they sent me to Fort Sam Houston, Texas, which is near San Antonio, and then after that training, back to Fort Riley, and then off to Vietnam on a troop ship.
So, Dan, what about you? How did you get into it?
Well, I made the mistake of dropping out of college.
Yeah.
My first experience with Vietnam, I was in high school, and I dated a girl. And I would ask her about her father, and she would say, well, he's in the Army. And then one day I was visiting her at her house, and I noticed a picture of her father on the mantle. And so I asked about him, and she said, well, he's in Vietnam. He's there as an advisor. And I said, what's Vietnam?
Oh, this is really early on.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, I would consider myself to essentially have my head in the sand during high school and college years and that sort of stuff. So it didn't mean anything to me for quite a while. And so I was in college for a while, and then I decided to go get a job and do something for some reason, and So I was working, and it didn't occur to me that because I had dropped out that that meant that I was then first choice for the draft. And so then I got this letter, and it says, greeting. Mm-hmm. And so my father said, don't volunteer for anything. And what I learned was is that everybody else takes a step back, and you're stuck anyway, so what difference does it make? But from there, I was drafted, and I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana. And then I went to, I think it was Fort Gordon, and they had me destined to be a helicopter mechanic. And I'm glad that they that I didn't wind up going that way, because that would have meant I would probably be in forward areas and in bases that would come under fire, et cetera. So one day a sergeant came and said, you, and said, get on the bus. And so we all got on the bus, and we wound up in military police school. And I think that was probably a handy thing to have. I also went over in a troop ship, and this was at the very beginning of the surge. So it went from advisors to active involvement, and then it was like, well, this active involvement isn't cutting it. We need more troops, and so I was on the front end of that. As a matter of fact, the military police unit that I was with, the entire company went over at the same time on the troop ship. And so, and the advantage of that was that the troop ship was a month voyage, and that counted as a year, or counted in your year of tour, your tour year.
That's right.
So that meant that I think we sailed in September. No, we sailed in October and came back in September, something like that. And it came back by airplane, which was nice. It was much quicker. I didn't care much for the troop ship. As I recall, the bunk above me was about 3 inches above my nose because they were stacked. I don't remember how they. Yeah, it literally was. I mean, it was designed to carry troops. It wasn't designed to be a pleasure craft by any means. So it seems to me like the bunks were like 5 or 6 high.
Oh, I think more than that.
More than that?
Yeah. Really?
I remember climbing.
I lived on a ship like that for a while, and they were floor to ceiling. And yeah, when you say mm-hmm. 5 or 6 inches, you're not joking.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. By the way, had you done that helicopter gig, you would have been more than in a forward area. You would have been a crew chief, which flies on the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
One of the two gunners is the crew chief, who's the mechanic for the helicopter.
Ah, that I did not know.
Huh.
I figured I'd just be in a base somewhere and working on helicopters. And
yeah, until you went out picking up bodies or inserting troops. Or,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So, okay, so it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like y'all kind of went into it in a sort of an innocent way. You had to go one way or another, and you didn't have like a very thought-out philosophy. You're really young guys. When did it start to get real to you that something was happening here that was pretty intense?
Basic training.
Yeah, what was that like?
Yeah. Well, they start you off to indoctrinate you into this whole discipline thing. And they start you off marching up, 2, 3, just right off the bat.
Yeah.
And then it's like you get up the next morning, and before breakfast, they hand you these big, heavy cast iron things that are practice grenades. And so you go out and you throw those, and you do a bunch of push-ups and you sit-ups and maybe go on a hike or something like that before breakfast, and then finally you get to eat. And the indoctrination is incredible at basic training. It's you get yelled at a lot, you get demoralized, you get degraded.
You see this on TV and movies lot. And
I remember the thing that the drill sergeant said was, your mother has had 18 years to form your behavior in your life, and I've only got 8 weeks to change that. And that was kind of it.
The idea is you had people from all walks of life when they were drafting people, and they wanted to bring everybody down to a common denominator. So if you were mm-hmm. a banker or a truck driver, you were, at the end of 8 weeks, you were equal.
Right.
I think, like, you were already through college, but I think that most of us in 1966 were not college types. Mm-hmm. And So it was a little different. I had very few college graduates that I met when I was in country there. So I think that's probably a difference. And that's probably why the war finally ended, because not to say you were privileged, but it was not much of a stretch for me being told what to do and being demeaned and so on, because I just worked in jobs that were kind of menial, manual type jobs. And
being the young guy on the block, you'd get that kind of treatment from the old guys and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you were nodding, Gary. What were you thinking about?
Well, for me, it was different. Of course, you know, I went through a lot of training, too, down in San Diego. And yes, it was rough, and it sounds, you know, they'd come and scream in your face and just debase you. And I heard curse words I had never heard before. You know, it was just so degrading. But I knew that that was part of, I expected that. I truly did. But for me, the reality of the war was more when I got, after your basic training happens, then I went on to language immersion programs for almost 2 years. And that was just like an extension of college.
I bet.
Yeah. I mean, we had so many just wonderful instructors, and we were pampered and babied. I got to admit, you know, Hank is right. You know, it was a lot different for me. But when it dawned on me what was really happening was once I got over to the country, and I got picked up by the air flight crews, and I realized that, hey, people are shooting at this airplane I'm in. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'll talk about this more later. But you know, my first job was to keep the airplane, help to keep the airplane in the air by reporting conversations when they're tracking you, or tracking other American planes, whether they be bombers or fighters or whatever, or helicopters.
So your job was to listen in and then translate what the other side was saying
so
about who they were wanting to shoot at,
your own
and things
backside
like that.
In the air first, and then your other, you know, other.
Oh, so you'd be doing
planes.
That from an airplane.
Yes, you're doing it from an airplane.
Yeah, okay.
So it was significant whether they were tracking you with surface-to-air missiles or vectoring aircraft towards you, fighter aircraft towards you, or something. So they were tracking or trying to track all American activity in the air. Of course, we had great air superiority, but part of that superiority was listening in on their conversations and translating real time.
What altitude did you fly?
I couldn't tell you. Quite high.
Quite high.
Okay. The higher, the better, I imagine.
The higher, the better. It was not towards the end that actually they were flying much lower, and we were intercepting ground communications, you know, as they were relaying messages from Hanoi to Haiphong, and then all the way down the coast, they would relay from one station to another. And some of that we had to be pretty low. And so mm-hmm. that was the first time I could actually see fields and trees and cars moving along a road, things like that. But it was still, for me, it was still very sanitized, but it was worrisome to be that low.
You were getting shot at.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not too sanitary.
You know, when a missile is launched, you don't have much time for evasion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When it first hit home for me during basic training in those days, they would make you crawl under barbed wire with live 50 caliber machine gun fire going over your head. That was one thing that, I guess I won't be standing up. And it was muddy, and it was pretty gross. Then you also got to throw a live grenade. That was part of the training. So that's when it first hit home to me. When it really hit home is there was one suicide on the ship going over. Somebody jumped overboard. It was not the last suicide I was to, being a medic, be directly involved in. And that was hard to deal with.
Yeah.
These are your peers. And
Right.
I can remember when I first got there, I was scared to death, but I also thought it was kind of an adventure. I was wandering around in the jungle with all these guys with guns and everything. I thought it was, although it was scary, it was kind of fun. And I can remember one time being in a major firefight, and for the first hour or two, it was just exhilarating. And you hear people talk about people being in situations like that, and you're on kind of a high. And I was like that for, oh, I don't know, a couple of hours until my group had moved into another area where we were taking direct fire that was being aimed at us, and two or three people around me were killed, and it stopped being, the exhilaration went away, and it stopped being fun.
Yeah. One thing that I'm curious about, and you were talking about in the boot camp that they, you know, demeaned you and brought you down to a certain common denominator level. But there's this wonderful camaraderie with your band of brothers, as they say, right? And how does that come about, do you think?
You're both in the same situation.
Yeah.
And you have to depend on one another. All political differences go away. I mean, you may argue about whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, you adopt this attitude that we all have to stick together. And for me, because the highest rank I ever got was corporal, because I was a draftee. I mean, if I'd have signed up, they gave me all sorts of opportunities, and my father said, don't volunteer for anything. So I just saw any move along that direction as being potentially suicide, and that was probably correct. But to me, as soon as the landing craft dropped the front door, and this was in a secure area, but I didn't know this at the time,
uh-huh.
And as soon as that door dropped and I was on the sand on Vietnam, it's like suddenly it was a whole different world that I lived in. And I thought that that world went away when I got on a plane to leave. I remember thinking to myself when the plane finally got pretty far up in the air and I could see ocean down below, I said, well, we're out of rocket range. So I wasn't worried about it anymore, I thought. I didn't realize that later on the PTSD was still there. But nonetheless, I mean, to me, it's just there's a whole different attitude that you and, you know, you two guys, the medics here, can pretty much attest, you know, everybody's in it together.
And you're spending huge amounts of time together with nothing distracting you from that other than, you know, everything you're mm-hmm. doing together, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's very present because you've got to be paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
You're not thinking about stuff back in the past or in the future much.
Actually, maybe there's, for me anyway, I'm not going to speak for anybody else, but for me, it seemed like, oh, we were joking about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a lot of laughter. There was, we were trying to make fun of this and that and so on and so on. So I'm not going to say that it was all just being uptight all the time. And there were, of course, the beer tents. And mm-hmm. At one duty assignment, I was fortunate enough to have a concrete barrack and a bar at the other end. And that's one thing that the military is very generous with, which is liquor. Mm-hmm. And they tend to set up R&R and stuff like that so you can have a good time. And there were the good times amongst it all, but there's this prevailing, it's kind of like trying to cross the street, I guess, is one of the best ways I can think of to illustrate it, is that you're cautious. You look both ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dan talks about the joking. The joking would go on even during firefights. I don't know if it was a way of dealing with it or what, but we were always laughing and yelling back and forth at each other. Whenever I got to a casualty, the first question the casualty would ask me is, am I going home after they realized they were going to live? Am I going home? And it would be yelled like up and down the line, is he going home? And we all joked about things like that.
It's
gallows humor.
Yeah.
I was going to use that exact term, gallows humor. And there was, even though, and I began to gain respect, you know, in basic training, they whittle you down to nothing, you know, but once I was in Vietnam as a medic, then you're doc, and everybody's looking out for you, because mm-hmm. they mm-hmm. need you.
Right.
But it was very much reciprocal in that we all, like band of brothers, whatever, you knew that somebody had your back, and that was reassuring, and so when somebody did get wounded or die, you took it very hard. And this is an experience, I don't want to get political, but I will, that unless you've been there, and experience that, unlike our president, then you don't know how to cover somebody's ass. You know,
loading the body of a dead 19-year-old covered with mud on a helicopter is pretty sobering, and something you don't quickly forget. The first casualty I had die on me was there was nothing I could do. I was always concerned of two things: one, that somebody would die on me because I did something wrong, and the other thing that really bothered me is somebody would be injured and he would die because I was afraid to go where he was, which the other soldiers expected us to do regardless, and every time a medic would get shot or killed, the battalion surgeon would call us all in and say, you can't do that, you're not bulletproof. If he got shot there, you're going to get shot there.
Right.
You just have to say no sometimes. I'm glad neither of those things happened to me, so I'm not haunted with that. I would probably have PTSD if it did happen.
These are very sobering thoughts to me because it gives me a reality of what was happening on the ground. And I knew that on some level, but to hear you guys speak of it, it's very sobering.
So were you where, could you actually see where the bombs were hitting and things like that?
At times, yes.
And what did you think of the fact that there were people that those explosions were taking place?
Well, I didn't see the people typically.
I know you didn't see them, but you knew they were there.
But yes, we could see the explosions and things, and then we were there to listen to, one of the things they always did, was to give a bomb damage assessment report. This is the North Vietnamese.
Right.
So when we would see things like that, some of the bombing, they'd get right on the radio and report to their own headquarters, and they'd say, oh yeah, the American pirates, they always called us pirates for some reason, and they implied we did things with children and ate them. but they would...
Well, we just burned them with napalm. We wouldn't eat them.
Well, unfortunately,
they weren't any good then because it always ruined the bodies.
So they would say things like, well, the American pirates, they attacked this base and or this depot, and they killed seven people, and they destroyed the ammunition dump, but don't worry, they didn't get the fuel depot on the other side of the hill. Well, 15 minutes later, we would get the fuel depot on the other side of the hill.
You know, we see things like when you watch... movies of Vietnam, you're always seeing these planes coming in and dropping napalm, and that's on your little screen, even if you have a 55-inch screen, but to see it in real life and realize that there's people in those flames is pretty sobering as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's that famous picture of one of the Vietnamese, she was probably 5'6", something like that.
Oh,
she's running down the road perfectly naked to escape the, I think, napalm. I don't remember for sure.
That was a Vietnamese plane that bombed where she was.
Yeah.
It wasn't an American
plane. Oh, was
plane.
It?
Yes.
Yeah. But I remember she went on and she got political. And I don't really remember what her message was exactly, but I think it was basically anti-war.
Anti-war. She lives in Canada now.
Does she?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it would, in the case of that young girl, it would have either been napalm or white phosphorus. And, you know, there's no brushing white phosphorus off your skin. You know, you just have to smother it. And it was a terrible thing that our country did to us at that age and at that point in our lives.
White phosphorus was never meant to be anti-personnel. It was a marking round.
Right.
And when you call in artillery on a location, often, especially if you're fairly close, they'll fire one of these, it explodes 100 feet up in the air, and it's a marking round, it's a big white, and that lets you know that you're on the right place, or you may have to adjust the artillery. But we frequently used it, what we call the Willie Peter on the deck, white phosphorus on the deck, and it was used as anti-personnel.
So as a medic, did you ever have to treat Americans or anybody with those types of burns?
No.
I didn't either. I don't want to overstate my case, but I knew what it could do, and I'd seen the end result of it.
Where I was in Vietnam, and at the time I was in there, the enemy had no artillery or aircraft or anything like that. So we were basically fighting riflemen. They had mortars. I guess a mortar could probably fire a white phosphorus, but I don't know if it did.
Yeah, that was our, being in an armored unit, armored cavalry, we were driving around smashing the jungle down like sitting ducks, and The mainly what we encountered were landmines, occasionally followed up with automatic weapons fire and mortar attacks. When we were in some kind of a base camp, there were a lot of mortar attacks, and you could hear them, made a whistling sound. You could hear them come in and time it as to just about when they would hit.
And kind of the interesting thing too is you could occasionally, we would set up in a providing security for a fire support base, which would be an artillery base. And artillery, you can imagine the noise they make. And when it was your turn, if you weren't on watch, you went to sleep, regardless of how loud the artillery was. But if one 40-millimeter mortar round landed in the base, it woke everybody up. Your mind is still awake and can tell the difference between outgoing and incoming rounds, and you wake up instantly.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the things that really hurts a person psychologically, is not being able to rest really deeply, because you're always kind of on that alert.
You know, I just remember sleeping well in the field. I liked camping at the time, and other than the fact that people were trying to kill me, I liked going out in the woods, and I was always interested in the wildlife and the snakes and spiders and things like that. So I thought it was kind of fun, except when they were shooting at me.
So I imagine, and you can straighten me out on this one too, when you're in a base, some bases you probably feel really safe, and other bases you're kind of in the forward areas and mm-hmm. anything can happen, so you're really way more alert all the time.
Exactly. There are areas like Cameron Bay were very, yeah. very secure, Vung Tau, places like that. But just because they were secure didn't mean they were necessarily safe. You could have the safest job in Vietnam, and still you were subject to being attacked. After Tet happened, the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong attacked a lot of these secure places, and they really overran and did a lot of damage in Saigon. And we used to watch television every now and then when we were someplace where there was television. They'd have the Armed Forces News, and they'd have these guys, I don't remember their army or sailors or what they were, reading the news, just like you're reading the news at home, in their Class A's.
Yeah, it was in MOS.
I'm sorry?
It was in MOS.
What's yeah, okay.
I have a friend who was in the Air Force, and he worked in the Air Force radio, and he never saw any combat at all. I don't remember where he... I think he was stationed stateside, but no, it's an actual MOS, yeah.
What's so an MOS?
Military Occupational Specialty. I think that's what it stands for.
I think so, something like that. Yeah.
So really the only
But after Tet, these same guys who were la-di-da in their Class A's were in fatigues and scared. You could see they were scared. So even a safe job like that was not safe.
So really the only time you could relax is like getting an R&R to Pattaya or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I felt far more secure than that. I'm kind of like Gary in a sense, and I think that it's because military police was my job. And so some of the things that I did, I found them traumatic. Nonetheless, but some of the things that I did was investigate accidents where GIs were involved in either a GI to, or, you know, military to military type accident, or the ones I really found tragic were deuce and a halfs would pick off bicycle riders because they would be right on the side of the road.
A deuce and a half?
It's a big truck.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So one of our trucks would
Wipe
somebody out.
To me, one of the problems with the military is that you want gung-ho young guys who are hot rodders. And yeah, they were. I was one of them. I mean, you know, one of the things we did, for example, we escorted the Coca-Cola trucks up the Saigon Highway with jeeps with machine guns on the back. I don't know why we had well, just for general defense, I guess. But, you know, it's not like we're going to stop somebody from stealing Coca-Cola off the trucks just because we've got a machine gun. But we'd be drag racing once the trucks were there and all of that. We were going back to Saigon, and we would be drag racing down the Saigon Highway. So and it goes back to this laughter and fun and that sort of thing. But it was the hot rod element that essentially was picking off civilians
on purpose
with
accident.
I think by accident, just carelessness.
You know, one of the things that I never got as any of my training, of, excuse me, very, very little, was cultural sensitivity. Mm-hmm. We knew absolutely zero about the Vietnam culture. I can remember being taught in some of my, what they called RVN training, that if somebody offers you something to drink, it's they're insulted if you don't take it, so you should take it even if it's in a dirty glass and all that. But we knew nothing about what these young girls in the white dresses were. We thought they were students, but we didn't know, and we were taught nothing about how to respect the civilian population.
So you would spend probably most of the time on a base or in the field, but you still had some interaction in towns and things like that?
Yeah,
like,
if you were in a place like I spent the last 5 months as an MP. I'll get into the story about that happens if we have time. But I was stationed in Long Bend, and there was a town, Benoit, not very far away. And mm-hmm. when you're off duty, get in your civilian clothes, go downtown and get drunk.
Right.
Go hang out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the Saigon area and the Benoit area, Long Bend, that's, I started out in Long Bend, and then they transferred me to a medical facility in Benoit. And that's when I realized that I had this nice concrete barrack and a bar at the other end. So those areas were generally fairly secure. I spent my last few months, I don't remember how many, at the ammunition offload site, which was upriver from Saigon, about 15 miles, and we had three ships laden with ammunition of one sort or another, and they would offload it onto barges. So we patrolled the harbor and escorted the tugboats up the river, and that's where I got shot at. You know, I got shot at. It was sporadic, and generally we didn't shoot back or anything. Generally, our best defense was the accelerator pedal and just get the hell out of there.
So snipers on the riverbanks kind of thing?
Well, the whole area, the reason we were escorting was because the whole area was infested with the Viet Cong. And the good news is we had air support, because the helicopter gunships came in, and if there was any sign of activity along anywhere near us, they engaged that. And jets, they would bomb. And mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how did your thought, I know you're still young men, even at the end of your experience, but still, you came in it pretty naive. How did your thoughts about it change as you went through the experience? Or was it like, you know, you were talking about earlier, there were a lot of joking and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and just basic survival till you get it done? Or did you have an intellectual process going on about it?
No.
At the time?
No.
Not really?
And I think that's part of the problem. I think a lot of guys came back and mm-hmm. are still coming back from conflict areas, and a lot of guys came back and just thought, oh, it's over. Mm-hmm. And they didn't realize that the reason that they were so angry was because they came back from a war. And I know I was. I was angry all the time. I can look back at that and realize that that's what it was. But I didn't realize why I was angry. I thought I was right. You know, when you get angry, you think you're right. And but I took it out on my wife at the time. I took it out on the dog. I took it out on my family and that sort. And it wasn't until I was in my 50s that it suddenly dawned on me, PTSD. And then mm-hmm. I went to the VA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As to our mental health, there was a slang term. When you got down to your last 30 days in country, you were known as a short timer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you'd say like 25 days and a wake up. Yeah, and then you were going home. And I remember about 10 days before I was due to go home, I was ordered, I guess, to go on a search and destroy mission. And I just said I wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And if I had stayed in country another 3 weeks, I could have gotten what they called an early out and gone directly from Vietnam home. But I didn't want to do that. I was willing to stay in the Army for another 3 months. And as it turned out, the Tet Offensive in December 67 occurred within that period of time. So it was a good thing I got out when I did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'd left before the Tet Offensive.
Yeah.
You know, he was talking about having 10 days left. One of the things, when I mentioned before, that nobody's safe, I had about a week left in country, and there was somebody who was literally a tansonut waiting for his plane. He was in his Class A's and was killed in a mortar attack. So he had literally hours left in country, and he was killed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think your original question, too, was what kind of experience, how did we process it while we were in country? And for me, there were several experiences while I was there that were very enlightening to me. The first thing that happened when I, not within a week after landing, they wanted me to participate in an interrogation on base. It was from by a young man had stolen a bicycle, or at least that's what he was being accused of. He had thrown it over a fence, and one of the MPs caught a young man. They didn't catch him there. So it was debatable whether they caught the right young man or not. But they were interrogating him, and they wanted me to verify the translation. Of course, they were being interrogated by Vietnamese nationals. They weren't being interrogated by Americans. But there were Americans, including me, in the room. And while we technically did not torture, you know, Americans, we had what was a precursor to what they call rendition now, where you torture people, let foreign nationals do it. And so that's effectively what they were doing. They were questioning this man and very demanding and aggressive and slapping him, and they basically interrogated him with his head in a water bucket. And it was very gross, and all I had to do was verify the translation. I think, though, while that happened, and that was a pretty minor incident, I actually think it was more, perhaps a more of a test of me to see what I was willing to do, because I was interviewed not long after that by a member of Naval Security Group, and I was asked what I thought of that. And I looked him squarely in the eye, and I said, well, I would have admitted to it. Certainly, I said, and I want no part of this ever again. I was never asked to do that again. I was picked up by the flight program fairly soon right after that.
And but you all, being interviewed kind of seems like a tip-off that it was some kind of a test.
Yeah. I think that was more for my benefit. I know things like that went on, but probably not for that minor of a thing, in my opinion. But then, you know, another thing that I learned as I went along is we had access to, because I was in country and I had to have a top secret security clearance, we had access to all data that was pertinent in country. You know, I couldn't access what was happening top secret in Germany, but I certainly could in Vietnam. And just some of the documents and reports that I read in great detail. They have big tomes on the Marcoses and every, you know, and you could read about what kind of criminals they were. And the United States was very aware of who these people were and everybody in government and whether they had a criminal history or not. And to me, it was so enlightening to see, to hear the news on one side and hear, you know, Kissinger or somebody going over and talking with a Vietnamese official, and you hear it on the American news, but then you see these reports, and they were many times very, very gross, just nasty. And we knew full well that we were dealing with just terrible people. So that was enlightening to me.
Mm-hmm. So what did you think when you started to come home? Like, I know you must have been totally relieved to get out of there. But, maybe before we go there, is there anything else you want to talk about being in country and you know, any other experiences that you wanted to share or thoughts? I don't want to move too fast
off of that. I'd like to make a definition of something that Hank said a little while ago when he talked about search and destroy missions. What a search and destroy mission meant is you went out in the woods until they attacked you.
That's right.
Say that again.
Okay.
I didn't hear that.
You went out in the woods until you were attacked, and that's how you found the enemy.
Gee.
You searched and they destroyed you.
Right.
I know. My first husband, who was a Marine at a very early age and went over enlisted and all that, and he spent most of the war apparently on a hill with two guys, just out there by himself, more or less, with two guys.
Huh.
And I can't even imagine what that might have been like, just like you said, waiting for somebody to come across your path that you don't want to see. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I also had a fellow interpreter. He was actually a Vietnamese national. He didn't do the same work I did, but he interpreted on base because he grew up there. And it was such an interesting thing to see him. It relates back to another topic we have already passed, but you know, you mentioned that you didn't have sensitivity training or cultural training and stuff. And one of the things I learned from my friend Suha, I later sponsored him and got him back to America because he would have been killed for interpreting, you know, and cooperating with the American bases and stuff like that. But one of the things I learned from him was, you know, so many of the villagers who many people described as Viet Cong would go back and forth. I mean, they would switch sides only to survive. You know, they really didn't care whether it was Uncle Sam or Uncle Ho. Uncle Ho, by the way, is a national hero.
And by and large, a lot of them, their biggest concern was, please don't shoot my cow. And again, hot rod teenage guys with guns,
yes,
they would shoot the cows.
Yeah, or water buffalo.
Yeah.
It was funny, when we would, there'd be a company of armed infantrymen crossing a rice paddy, and if there was a water buffalo on the edge, the water buffalo might get angry and start to attack this company of armed men. So we actually had people with what do they call them? Rocket launchers, things. That's not what they were called, but that's what they did. They fired
M-79.
Well, no, not M-79. M-79s or LAWs, L-A-W, would be on that side of the formation in case the border buffalo attacked. We could kill it. But some little kid who weighed no more than 50 pounds, soaking wet, would come out with a stick, and the water buffalo would run away from him.
Mm.
It's amazing what you can do with a stick.
With a stick, yeah. And if you're the boss, too.
Yeah. I'd watch people up on a hill, soldiers up on a hill, and a M79 grenade launcher looks like a sawed-off shotgun with a huge...
two-inch bore.
Barrel, yeah, bore. And they would lob these grenades at water buffalo. And you talk about cultural insensitivity... You know, these people's livelihoods depended upon those water buffalo.
Incredibly important. That was their work animal. That was incredibly important to them.
And if you're a peasant and not really political, just trying to survive, then whoever's coming through town this week is who you want to be agreeing with,
exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I always had the impression, and I don't know if I'm wrong, but Gary speaking the language and knowing people probably knows more than I do. I think he was saying this is, I always had the feeling that the people that we were dealing with couldn't care less who won. They just wanted it to be over.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's true.
It's happening in their living room.
I mean, you can picture yourself, you're a peasant living out in a rice paddy in a little grass house, and here comes 150 people with guns who don't speak your language being mean to you, marching through. I remember one night because I was the medic, I used to set up with the platoon CP, the platoon command post, with the lieutenant and the platoon sergeant and the RTOs, the radio operators. And they actually always picked the most comfortable place to set up at night. And this one particular night, we were in somebody's house, a little grass house. And these old people were just bowing and begging. And they were terrified at first. And they're pointing to... who I imagine was their son on a little altar. All these little houses had altars in them, wearing a Vietnamese uniform, showing us, you know, we're the good guys. I thought, what a horrible, horrible experience for these people. And we had no way of telling them, don't worry about it, you're all right.
Exactly, yeah. You know, one of the things, too, I think is important to realize that these people's lives probably weren't going to, I mean, they were subsistence farmers.
Right.
So poor, just desperately poor, and their lives weren't going to change whether the Americans won or the Tews won for the South Vietnamese government or the Communists won. Their lives weren't going to change much either way. They just didn't want to be hurt. They wanted to support their families.
So we're Well, we could just go on forever, I have a feeling, but...
Yeah, I was going to say, you could probably do a whole nother hour on this.
Yeah, definitely.
Because we've only scratched part of the experience.
I'm sure of that. We really could do that, and it'd be really worthwhile. But as we start to wind down a little bit, how did you come to terms with these things, either immediately or over the years?
When I was coming home, the plane landed in the Philippines, mm-hmm. and you get off the plane and you're in the Philippines, which looks exactly like Vietnam, and these little Asian guys running around in camouflage uniforms and stuff. But after a few minutes, I realized none of them have guns, and the war is over. You're not there anymore. And it kind of washed away from me. But I, for a long time, did have some of the symptoms Dan talks about, of being angry all the time. And I've never, every now and then, I shot somebody at close range at about 20 feet, and he looked like he was 15 years old. And every now and then I think about that person, but he would have killed me. In fact, he did just shoot a helicopter down and kill somebody. So
I imagine self-defense plays into it in your
exactly,
mind a lot.
Yeah, but I often think, well, gee, you know, maybe under different circumstances, maybe he had some of the same hobbies I did, and we could have been buddies or something like that. But I can't say like it bothers me, because he would have killed me.
Yeah.
Well, I flew in first to Honolulu and then Oakland. And I remember I had these little khaki short sleeve dress uniforms on, and I was freezing to death. Here I was from Seattle, you know, so I was used to cold, wet climate. And my main thing was once I was there, again, I was not, I was just a high school graduate, and, you know, nobody spit on me or anything like that, but there were these looks, you know, like I was crazy or something. And so there's the stigma, I think, of being a crazy Vietnam vet, which I carry with me to this day.
Tell me why I couldn't get a job when I got out of the Army.
Yeah. On my music show that I also host, I just played a song this week about a guy whose name I can't think of right now, Richard Shepherd, I think it was. He climbed up in the tower of Austin.
University of Texas.
University of Texas. Yeah. There's some type of a tower, and he shot a bunch of people. By today's standards, he'd be an amateur. He only had 700 rounds with him and one or two guns. And but it was widely said in the news that he was a Vietnam vet, and he kind of started the idea of the gooned-out Vietnam vet that you need to be afraid of, and turned out he'd never been in Vietnam at all. He was a Marine, but he hadn't been in Vietnam.
Right, the Rambo series and all of that stuff, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What comes to mind in terms of you coming to terms with the experience, Gary?
Well, you know, for me, it was so different, you know, and for the end, it wasn't until the end of the war that I ever saw any egregious wounds or anything. The day after Saigon fell, I was transferred to Subic Bay to help at the hospital there, because that's where the egregiously wounded were being transported to Subic Bay Naval Facility, their hospital. And so I was helping with them, helping facilitate their care and stuff like that, or doctors, you know, for examinations and things that need translation. So that's the first time I ever came into contact with people that were egregiously wounded. And then, you know, after a couple weeks of that, I was flown out back to Oakland. But, you know, I had longer hair, and just because we never had to stand an inspection or anything like that. And so I kind of took off my uniform and walked right into society. I mean, nobody could tell I had been in the military.
So you
but
were
I didn't
also,
talk about it either.
Yeah. See, that's the thing that I've heard, and you mentioned it too, that there was some kind of a stigma that you'd been there because the protests were so high energy at that point. At a lot of conversation didn't really happen with vets about their experience.
Yeah, I don't think we were particularly, we weren't proud of having been there. It was denial, and it was better left unsaid. Mm-hmm. I didn't discuss it with people. I immediately grew my hair and beard out and started right. college and never looked back.
Put it behind you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I probably talked more about it in the last year than I did in the preceding 49 years.
Yeah, me too. Yeah,
and I can thank alcohol for being immersed in some sort of fantasy for a while. So, and yeah, there are different coping mechanisms, I think. And for me, it was being being angry and being sedated on a good vodka, whatever.
Right. So
tequila was my favorite.
Yeah. So, in terms of dealing with it, you were young. The politics were against you at the time, so it was more about putting it behind you. But I imagine that experience has changed you in ways that you could maybe talk about a little bit now.
It made me more political, actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for me too.
Me too.
Once I realized,
learning that Kissinger lied and the whole thing was a farce.
Once I realized all that stuff, that's when I became a very liberal and very anti-war. And so for years after I came back, I thought, well, if we'd only stuck it out a little longer and that type of thing. I was one of those. And then I started reading about some of the history and what actually happened, and I said, wait a minute, that's not the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's one thing that's kind of, my own children disappoint me in some level in today's society because they're so uninterested in politics, and I'm not going to turn this into a political discussion, don't worry, but they need to vote. You know, and they chose not to in this last election, and it really created a division for me and my own family. And I've been political since Vietnam ended.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's one thing that I could say about the experience, and even though I mean, my experience wasn't nearly as heavy as either Hank or Ray, But the one thing that I think that I came away with on the experience is that one thing that I then understood is that in the blink of an eye, the whole world could change. Somebody could bomb somebody, and then somebody could retaliate, and the next thing you know, we'd all be armed and fighting for our lives. That's a reality. That's something you don't consider to be a reality unless you've been in it and seen it. And Hank, you kind of alluded to it. Well, Gary, you too. You said, you know, this is an experience that changes your perspective of the world.
I really worry about all the video games and movies and things like that that glorify war and make it look like an exciting adventure.
Right.
We're militarizing our youth.
Well, we're just about out of time, and I appreciate everything you said. I love what you said about, you know, it's an experience that changes you in profound ways. And we could certainly do more hours of this. I want to thank you all for being here and sharing your experience. I would like to have a part two. Maybe we could talk about the war at home a little bit. Again, thank you so much. And thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.